and I haven't had a good cup of coffee since I've been here. I've been, like, stuck in the Holiday Inn Express.
Why didn't you talk to me right away?
Right when we landed.
Hello and welcome to Save Our Protection of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we're talking about coffee.
Yes. The big one.
Oh, yeah. We've been honestly putting this off because it's so big and so much.
Yes. And there are so many avenues we could have gone down.
Oh, like gosh.
Coffee brewing methods, different types of coffee drinks like lattes, cappuccinos. Mm-hmm. But really, for our sanity, for your sanity, for respecting those topics, they should be their own episodes.
Absolutely. And we will glance through another few things on here, like a instant coffee, stuff
yeah.
like that deserves its own time and space.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, like, we could honestly do an entire season just on, like, coffee beans and coffee culture. But yeah, we're gonna see what we get through here today.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Because while we were on Oahu, we were fortunate to interview a fellow who sometimes goes by the name Dr. Coffee.
Indeed.
Or Sean Steinman, PhD. And he's the guy that you heard at the top there. And yes, I wish that we had gone to him immediately. He had so many recommendations. He's literally written the book on coffee, 3 actually. Just held up 4
she
fingers.
She did. I wasn't going to comment, but it's I like that okay. you admitted it.
Yep. He has a background in horticulture and chemistry. So he is a coffee consultant and a partner in Daylight Mind Coffee Company, which is a restaurant and roastery with 2 locations on the island of Hawaii. But yeah, he's based in Oahu, which is where we met up with him, in a room in a coffee house with a sort of menacing taxidermied peacock.
Yeah, this was another instance in which our Lyft driver, overhearing our meeting place, was a little concerned.
Yeah.
Inquisitive about what we were doing.
Because Sean texted and was like, well, I'm in the room with the peacock.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, what on earth does that mean? What are we walking into? Is this yep. a live peacock?
Yes. It wasn't.
It was not.
But we had many questions, and the Lyft driver, therefore, had many questions. He was even like, should you... Yeah, do you want to exchange numbers? They can tell me everything's okay. And we're like, I think it's going to be okay. I think Dr. Coffee is not going to
no.
murder us or sick a peacock on us. And he did not. He was great.
He was lovely. Yes.
He really was. And if it isn't obvious from past episodes, Lauren and I, and generally the office we work in, mm-hmm. We're big coffee people.
Mm-hmm.
Any day where the coffee machine isn't working in our office is what I describe as pure panic.
Mm-hmm.
Pure panic.
Yeah.
I always compare it to the troll in the dungeon scene from Harry Potter where Draco Malfoy, like, throws down his sweets uh-huh. and they all run out of the hall.
Yeah.
That's what it's like.
It's not dissimilar. and honestly, it's not even very good coffee.
No, it's not.
I discovered that coffee can have, like, flavors other than bitter or frappuccino. Only about 10 years ago, I would say. But I am pretty into it these days. Yeah, it's the first thing I consume every morning. I know that's terrible. I should hydrate. And I'm fairly sensitive to caffeine as well. So I have a hard limit of 3 cups a day.
Mine is 2 cups a day.
Oh, I'm proud of you.
But that's pretty recent. I instated that only after I figured out that I was addicted to caffeine.
Oh, well, sure.
Yeah, because... couple of years ago, I think 5 or so, I was waiting in line to see some famous celebrity at Dragon Con, and I had a massive headache, and mm-hmm. I just assumed hangover territory.
Sure.
Dragon Con. Yeah. I hadn't had my morning coffee, though, and so while I was waiting in the line, my friends held my space, and I went to go get coffee. The headache went away in what seemed like minutes.
Yeah.
Just amazing. All gone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years ago, I gave up coffee for a week or maybe 2. And the headaches I experienced during those week or so time period, brutal.
Oh, yeah.
So bad.
Yeah. No, I am also addicted to caffeine in a similar way. I mean, it's a drug. Back when I was a copy editor for HowStuffWorks.com, I got to edit a few articles about how caffeine and coffee work. And it's fascinating.
It is. But that brings us to our question, coffee. What is it?
Well, the beverage that we call coffee is a water infusion of the roasted seeds of plants in the genus Coffea. And there are a lot of species in that genus. at least 100, but the two most commonly grown are C. arabica and C. cannephora, aka arabica coffee and robusta coffee, respectively. Mostly arabica is grown, though. Robusta tends to taste a little flatter, but it is more caffeinated.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. These plants are large shrubs or smallish trees. Like, left alone, they can reach about 30 feet. That's around 10 meters in height. But for harvesting purposes, they're pruned shorter. And these plants produce huge clusters of these small, fragrant flowers, which, when pollinated, develop into clusters of berries, sometimes called cherries, that start out green and then turn red as they ripen. Each berry has a thick, bitter skin with a sweet, kind of like grape-textured flesh inside, and contains two bluish-green half-oval seeds, or sometimes one full oval seed, which is called a pea berry. Separate issue. So these plants evolved to produce caffeine because caffeine is toxic to some animals, and that caffeine is concentrated in the plant's seeds to discourage those animals from chewing on and thus destroying the seeds. But yet again, suckers, humans decided that we like that stuff.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We make coffee. We asked Sean what it takes to get one of those seeds, often called beans, into a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it actually, we have to go back farther than that because it is a seed of a plant, which means, like most seeds, it's surrounded by fruit. So we have this tree bush thing that grows in the field. Eventually, there are these fruit that ripen on it, and we need to get those fruit off the tree and then get the seed out and dry it down. And there's lots of ways you can do that. And the way you choose to do that has an influence on the flavor. And you might do it because of the flavor, but you might do it based on your resources at hand. So you get the seed out, you dry it down, you get all those layers off. There are many of them. And then it's this green dried seed, which kind of looks like a coffee seed, but doesn't really have any other familiarity to it. And that's the seed of commerce. That's what's going to move around the world. Or if you're in Hawaii, it's going to move down the street. All right, so this green bean has to go to a roaster, and the roaster, in its simplest form, adds heat to this seed. And through the course of their efforts, and that can be anywhere from, really, it can be anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes. Most people who really care about the coffee flavor aim for 8 to 12 minutes. And that process turns it from that green, hard seed to a brown seed that we all know and love in our everyday experience. Then someone, a home user, a cafe, a restaurant, grinds up in little pieces and runs water through it. And voila, we have a beverage that we call coffee.
And of course, that's the basic process. The whole thing is an art as much as it is a science. And people have opinions about what makes a coffee good. The part of that we often hear about is the roasting process, in which the green seeds are heated in big rotating drums. At around 400 degrees Fahrenheit, that's about 205 Celsius, the beans will pop and double in size and begin to brown as sugars in them caramelize, and that's called the first crack. Oils from inside the seeds will start to emerge and go through chemical changes called pyrolysis from the heat. The seeds will darken to a medium brown, and some of the coffee plant's bitter compounds will start to degrade, which is great. Then, at around 437 Fahrenheit, that's about 225 Celsius, the seeds go through what's called the second crack. They pop again and will start to look shiny as more oils emerge. And if you keep going, the seeds will turn black as those sugars in them caramelize and burn, and that's an espresso roast. But yeah, the length and heat of your roast is a balance between holding on to those raw sugars for their sweetness and letting those caramel flavors develop and getting those bitter compounds to go away. It's tricky.
Yeah. You know what this reminds me of? Do you know Jordan Schlansky from the Conan show?
Yeah.
He has so many opinions.
Oh, yeah?
About espresso and coffee. And I, like many people, are unsure if this is a character.
Oh.
Conan promises it's not a character, but I have a hard time believing it.
Sure.
But yeah, there's a, I think a remote, as they call them, where Jordan kind of gets in an argument with a professional barista about how coffee should be made. Because people have strong opinions, as you say.
They do.
But anyway, getting those seeds in the first place can be quite complicated, especially at scale. And it sometimes involves one of our favorite things.
Fermentation. So I mentioned there's several ways you can get the seed out of the fruit and dried down. Mm-hmm. And the one that most people are familiar with is referred to as fermentation. And there is actual fermentation, so it's legitimate from a microbiological standpoint. So we take this fruit, and inside is the seed, and you can just put a little pressure on it, and the seed pops out. And surrounding that seed, then, are two important layers. One is the outermost layer, which is this really sweet, sticky mucilage, which is quite tasty because it's all sugar. And beneath that is this very heavy, papery layer we call parchment because it's very parchment. You can dry down the seed with that sticky mucilage on, but it's risky because lots of things like sugar and water. So if you dry it down poorly, then things grow, and that growth tends to impart a flavor on the seed, which we don't like. So if you can improve your chances of success by drying that down, you're going to. So one way to do that is to remove all the sticky mucilage so that when you dry, the sugar's not hanging around causing trouble. So how do you do that? Well, historically, you don't have many options except letting nature do its work. So you can throw all the pile with the mucilage, all the seeds in a pile with the mucilage on, and just let it magically disappear. It's not magic, of course. It's native, naturally occurring microorganisms doing the work of degrading it. No one quite does it like that often. They tend to cover it with some water to even out the heat distribution to make it a little more likely to succeed well. But the same idea happens. You just cover it slightly in water, and microorganisms slowly eat away at the mucilage. They actually ferment it. We know that because there's CO2 bubbles and alcohol that appear. And then after some period of time, depending on the ambient temperature, all that sticky mucilage is degraded, and you can just wash off the seeds and dry them down. And then, of course, you have to later remove the parchment. There's another step after that, but that's what fermentation is. But you can skip that step. You can use a machine to scrape it off. Mm-hmm. You can dry the coffee down in the fruit. You don't even have to do any of that hard work. And that sort of makes the most sense if you have limited resources because you don't need the water to soak it. You don't have to clean the dirty water afterwards. You just dry it down. Of course, you need the right machine to remove all the layers.
Yeah.
You can leave the mucilage on. It's just risky. You can leave the fruit on, also risky. And all risky from the sense of things going wrong potential.
And, okay, y'all know that we asked follow-up questions about this because, you know, yeast poop. Yeah. So I asked what that fermentation contributes to coffee other than, you know, just getting the fruit off of the seed.
Fermentation in cacao is absolutely necessary because the seeds themselves need to change to become what we want them to become. Mm-hmm. Coffee, the step is totally not necessary. It's not good or bad. The argument to be made for fermentation process in coffee is that you get to, you can sort of define that as a baseline flavor of the coffee, the soul of the experience. Other processing methods tend to add on a flavor experience which is consistent with the process. So if you dry the coffee in the entire fruit, you tend to get a very consistent end flavor, which is jammy, fruity, berry kind of flavor. Mm-hmm. If you leave the mucilage on, it gets a little bit sweeter, a little complexity, but the increased sweetness is pretty common. But without any of that, if you can just ferment it and dry it with a seed, you just get whatever the coffee is. Not good or bad, right? And that's a really important distinction when we talk about anything, not just coffee, that there's no right answer. We do things, we create flavors. Some people like them, some people don't. Just because an expert says, this is great, you should love this, doesn't mean it's good or bad. It just means they like it a lot. It doesn't make it better or good, or doesn't necessarily mean it should be more money or it should be more exclusive. It just means that the experts, who are very different from normal consumers, really like it.
And yes, there are a lot of coffee experts out there. It's a whole system. But there are also a lot of normal consumers.
Oh, yeah. Coffee is often dubbed the world's most popular drink. After oil, it is the world's most traded commodity, valued at over $100 billion.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And because of that, we have so many numbers for you.
Yeah.
54% of American adults have at least one cup of coffee every day, which honestly I find a little low. And that comes out to 425 cups of coffee sold per second in this country.
Huh.
New York City is thought to drink 7 times more coffee than any other city in the U.S., the city that never sleeps, indeed.
Hmm.
The daily average is 3.1 cups a day, and the average size of a cup here being 9 ounces. 65% of people drink coffee for breakfast. In the U.S., that comes out to an annual $40 billion spent on coffee. The industry employs 1,694,710 people in America.
Ooh.
In the decade between 2000 and 2010, coffee exports grew by 85%, up to $15.83 billion. Global coffee consumption is thought to be around 2.25 billion cups of coffee every day.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, let that sink in.
I don't know how much that is. That's too many. It's just big.
The brain has trouble processing. My brain, at least.
Oh, yeah. I honestly cut off after, like, 1,000. I'm like, that's about,
As high as it goes.
Yep. I'm like, anything else is just more, I guess.
Yeah. It's more than 1,000. We can say that for sure.
In the U.S., drip coffee is the most popular, or it's the way most coffee is consumed. And as of 2012, single-cup brewers took the second spot. Specialty coffee sales are going up 20% a year, and independent coffee shops make about $12 billion a year. As of 2014, Brazil produces the most coffee beans at 2.72 billion kilos. Vietnam comes in second with 1.65 billion, then Colombia, Indonesia, and Ethiopia.
And if I may bring up the 1998 Godzilla film for a second.
You may always bring up.
Thank you. There's a joke in there because there's like these French spies that are pretending to be American. And they have a joke where the guy is like, he sips on some coffee brewed in a Mr. Coffee or something. And he spits it out and he goes, "You call this coffee?" And the other guy goes, "I call this America." So we don't have a great reputation for coffee. Until semi-recently, I think that's changed.
Yeah.
Because this is 1998.
Okay. That's fair.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's what I always think of. The five largest coffee chains, which are Starbucks, Dunkin', Costa Coffee, Timmy Hortons, and McDonald's coffee, have 34,300 stores.
Ooh.
Yeah. And coffee has become something of a cultural phenomenon. Think those first coffee or don't talk to me until I've had my coffee shirts. Sean spoke a bit to coffee's popularity.
One of the really... Well, maybe the best thing that coffee has going for it is that it's not alcoholic. And when you are in high school and you want to have freedom and spread your wings, you can't go to a bar, but you can go to a coffee shop. And you can spend money on something that is affordable. The worst, most expensive cup of coffee you're often going to find in a geeky coffee shop is, I mean, really going to be what, like $6 at the worst. You can definitely find the occasional other, but $4 to $6 is totally accessible, especially if you have a part-time job, right? It's legal. And there's a status now associated with coffee. So there's a lot of, it's easy to get young people into coffee, I think. And some of them are never going to leave the milky flavored whatever because it's part status and it's part candy and it's just what they're always going to do. And it's always got that underlying magic called caffeine.
The word coffee may have derived from a romantic word for wine in Yemen. From there, we got the Turkish word for coffee, kahve, and then we got the Dutch koffie, and then the English coffee. The nickname Java originated in the 1800s when coffee was gaining popularity, and a decent amount of coffee came from the island of Java. As for the nickname Joe, that's a bit murky. One theory goes the nickname was a byproduct of a 1914 ban on alcohol on U.S. Navy ships enacted by Secretary of the Navy Josephus Joe Daniels. This meant that the stiffest drink sailors could get was a cup of black coffee. Historians don't really buy this story, though. Arguing that the phrase Cup of Joe didn't enter our language until the 1930s, derived from another nickname for coffee from that time, Jamoke, or maybe Jamocha, a combination of Java and Mocha. Or potentially, it simply is used the same way that we use when the same connotation when we say something like Average Joe. It was a drink for everybody, the everyman.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which brings us to nutrition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So caffeinate responsibly?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, okay, so coffee in its, like, plain hot bean juice state has just a few calories, like 2 to 5, from the oils in the seeds. Coffee drinks prepared with creamers and sweeteners can be wildly caloric. That's a whole different episode. But, yeah, there's a lot of research into the biochemical properties of coffee because it's such a globally popular beverage. Okay, very briefly, caffeine mm-hmm. aside.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so caffeine is a chemical stimulant that works because your brain creates this chemical called adenosine. And when that adenosine binds to the receptors in your brain that are shaped to lock it in, adenosine will slow your nerve cell activity down and dilate your brain's blood vessels, like it prepares you for sleep. You feel drowsy and there's extra oxygen floating around up there for your brain to work with while you're sleeping. Caffeine can bind to those same receptors, but it has the opposite effect. It speeds up your nerve cell activity and can constrict your brain's blood vessels, which is why some headache medicines contain caffeine and maybe part of how it helped out with your headache.
Yes.
That one day.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And also, caffeine, so like, okay, all that increased neuron activity that caffeine produces can trick your pituitary gland into thinking that there is some kind of emergency. And so your body produces adrenaline to help you deal with it. You know, like your heart beats faster, your blood vessels redirect blood away from the skin and toward the muscles, your liver gives you a kick of sugar to the bloodstream. And
yes.
Caffeine slows down the rate at which the feel-good neurotransmitter dopamine is reabsorbed in your brain, meaning that you'll have more dopamine floating around, meaning you feel real nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely mild version of what would happen if you were to take heroin, and it's why both of these drugs are addictive.
Wow. And that's just one compound in coffee.
Yeah. Oh, coffee is a fascinating cocktail. There are over 8,000 different compounds in your average cup. And all that processing stuff we talked about does subtly affect which ones happen and in what amounts. These things both add to coffee's flavor and to the potential health effects, from lowering your risks of cardiovascular disease and diabetes and cirrhosis, to protecting the brain from diseases like Parkinson's, to blocking cancer cells' movements in the body, to anti-inflammatory and antibacterial properties, but also potentially negative effects, especially if you drink more than like 3 to 5 cups a day, which can just jack up your stomach and your blood pressure and your sleep cycles. Jack up is definitely the science term.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And yes, caffeine can be toxic to we humans in very large amounts. Like, think like 30 cups of coffee, just like shotgun style.
Oh, gosh.
Don't do that. But just like really make sure that your house pets don't get into coffee, because their threshold, like cats and dogs, is a lot lower. Also, bad news.
Oh, no.
There's no erudite answer to the question, why does coffee make me want to poop?
What?
If you're not one of the humans for whom this happens, it does happen for a lot of us, supposedly women more often than men.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. But anyway, yeah, researchers think that it's likely a number of compounds that are interacting with your stomach lining or get into your bloodstream and then work together to create a neural and hormonal gastrocolonic response, meaning that you feel the need to defecate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yes, there is science about this. Our compatriot Christian Sager once wrote the weirdest Brain Stuff video script about it. It had me and Kristen Conger like sort of arguing and then talking about giving coffee enemas to rats and or Ben Bolin. it has never seen the light of day.
Oh, for which, tragedy.
I don't know if that's the correct word.
Here's where it gets crazy.
It's a tragedy for somebody.
For you, perhaps.
Yeah, me. Particularly.
But I digress. We were talking about coffee.
We were. Hawaii is the only U.S. state where coffee is produced, though it's also grown on Puerto Rico. A lot of you have probably heard of Kona Coffee, Hawaii's signature coffee product. In 2007, there was an estimated 7,800 acres of coffee being grown in the state.
While shopping for souvenirs for our friends back on the mainland, yeah, I looked at a lot of coffees around Oahu and was surprised to find that most were blends of like a little bit of Hawaiian coffee, maybe like 20%, with along with something produced elsewhere. But yeah, given those numbers, it makes sense. 100% Hawaiian coffee bags did exist, but they were expensive. And of course, there are reasons for that. We asked Sean, perhaps naively, what Hawaiian coffee is like.
So in Hawaii right now, there's about 1,000 coffee farms. And around the rest of the world, in every country, there's obviously many more. Hawaii is nothing on the world market, right? We're less than 0.03% of coffee production. If we got swallowed by the next hurricane or a flood, nobody would really care. The market certainly wouldn't care. And if you assume we have 1,000, that there are places that have tens of thousands of farms. And mostly, like, farms around the world are tiny, right? They're like an acre. So in a perfect world, every farmer has access to all the knowledge and resources they could possibly want. And they make a very active decision to how they're going to produce their coffee and what it's going to end up like and which market it should go to. In an ideal world. But that's not how it works, right? In an ideal world, you have natural variation. And we can map natural variation of anything on a curve, right? You just plot what the x-axis is, whatever it is that you want to measure. In this case, our conversation is quality of coffee. And the other y-axis is number of occurrences. When you do this through most natural things on the planet, you tend to get a bell curve. So if we took all the coffee in Hawaii and we mapped it on a curve, it would be a bell curve. And you'd have a big hump, which is, you know, average, ordinary, acceptably engaging coffees. You have one tail that is really disgusting, horrible stuff. And you have one tail that's really amazing and esoteric and extraordinary to explore. So when you start to say, oh, what are Hawaiian coffees taste like? Why are they special? First, you're talking about the tail, really, is what the question is. And that tail, by statistical measures, is, you know, you could make it 5%, but really we're talking 2%, which is 2% of 1,000 is 20. So not much we're talking about here. All right, so that is just part of the conversation. The other part of the conversation is this bit about terroir, a sense of taste of a place. And lots of farmers, every farmer in the world, wants their place to be really important. Right? My potatoes come from Idaho. They should be really tasty like Idaho. My wine comes from Bordeaux. It should taste like Bordeaux. My chocolate comes from Ecuador. It tastes like whatever that little valley in Ecuador is. And our coffee comes from Kona. It should taste like Kona coffee. And that's a beautiful romantic idea. It's not well explored in science. Partially because doing these sorts of tests are really difficult. Because you can't have two identical places next to each other that all the variables are controlled. So doing that test is really tricky. Hawaii's a great example because we had such a small place growing coffee for a while that we have this great case study. So in Hawaii, the only place growing significant amount of commercial coffee from about 1900 to about 2000 was Kona. So for about 100 years, they had the games themselves. And Kona's not that big a stretch, right? It's about, you know, up and down the mountain, it's about 3,000 feet, maybe a mile or two. Wow. Lengthwise across the ocean coast, if you will, go that way, it's, I don't know, 20, 30 miles. Like, it's not that big. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Kona really is just a political designation in a true sense of it. Mm-hmm. But there is a section on the Big Island we call Kona, and that's where coffee's been grown. Right? If you go back 50 years ago, people who were growing coffee in Kona were not growing coffee to sell as a bag of roasted product. Mm-hmm. They were growing a fruit. And they sold the fruit to someone else, and they were done with it. Yeah. So this guy who was buying all the fruit was buying lots of fruit from all these farmers and then doing all the processing to make green coffee and then selling it in a container to wherever. Now, there were maybe three or four of these people, right? These mills that were buying all this. You can imagine that all these little variations that might be happening based on farmer skill and climate, which is important to coffee, and any micro terroir issues are now being homogenized into one terroir idea. So all of a sudden, Hawaii does have a sense of place, a taste of place, because all the stuff's being blended together and shipped out. And there was, I think, a Kona coffee profile, flavor profile. Mm-hmm. People still talk about it, and we still sort of celebrate some of our competitions. Mm-hmm. But now that it doesn't work that way anymore, you can have one farmer selling roasted product of his own mm-hmm. or her own. Most of the steps they may do themselves, or maybe they'll contract out various bits. They have a lot of room to create unique experiences, right? That 2% of the bell curve. Mm-hmm. Now it's that flavor continuum is highly diverse and variable. So there's no really such thing as sense of place here because of the freedom to do different processes, different varieties, different roasts. Hawaii has some amazing coffees. I don't think they taste particularly like Hawaii. I bet if you looked hard enough around the world, you'd find other similar experiences. But you have to look and find them and capture all those things. And the more we allow for diversity of yeast and fermentation and how you dry it, how you do whatever you're going to do, like we're going to get more variations. And just not going to be, no one's going to be able to say, oh, this is what it tastes like. And our biggest challenge is that we're in Hawaii and our coffees cost way more than almost anywhere else on the planet. Even the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. Because we're Hawaii and there's a whole list of reasons why our coffees are more expensive. And I think they're quite legitimate. And if you dig deep enough, I think you might be convinced that it's not that our coffees are so expensive. It's that everybody else's coffees are way underpriced in an unfortunate, dark, evil way.
We'll come back to that dark, evil way in a moment.
Yeah, it's time for some deeper history. But first, it's time for a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Whew.
This was a tough one to wrangle.
Yeah. As it turns out, because of the popularity of coffee, it kind of had a hand in building, like, the world as we know it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the history about it is real muddled because a lot of people have had a hand in writing it.
Yes. Absolutely.
So, yeah.
We did our best.
We did our best.
So, coffee most likely originated in Ethiopia. Or possibly Yemen, but most people seem to think Ethiopia, where it was probably cultivated by 9th century CE in a region called Kaffa, though it was also probably chewed as a stimulant for hundreds of years prior to this. Enslaved peoples from Sudan are believed to have chewed on the beans to survive their treacherous and dangerous journeys on trade routes. There's a popular Ethiopian legend that coffee was discovered by a goat herder named Kaldi after he witnessed the energy level of his goats shoot up after they ate the coffee shrub's red fruit.
The goats started dancing.
Yes.
Dancing goats. Yeah.
Yes. A lot of articles that had this story in them had a gif of those goats just bouncing around to illustrate. So intrigued, Kaldi gave the berry a try and experienced a similar energy boost. Excited to share his findings and, in some versions, convinced by his wife, he brought some of the beans to a local monastery where they quickly were dismissed as suspect for their stimulating properties. The monks burned the beans, but the resulting aroma of roasted coffee beans enticed them enough to give the crop another go. however, this story didn't appear in the records until around 1671 CE, and it dates Kaldi to around 850 CE. So,
yeah,
grain of salt, mysteries of history, as always. And also, Yemen has a very similar legend. And even in their legend, sometimes the coffee bean came from Ethiopia first. Sometimes it came from Yemen first. Anyway.
Yeah. I think the general historical agreement is that the plant, probably Ethiopia. The drink, probably Yemen. Or
yeah.
Modern day versions of those. Yeah.
Yes.
At any rate, early preparations of the coffee fruit included mixing it with animal fat to make an early version of a protein bar, eating it in a sort of porridge, and fermenting the pulp to make something similar to wine. It was viewed by many as like a medicinal kind of thing.
One of the first written records of coffee, dating to 850-ish CE, was penned by Rahiz, or Raz, a physician and philosopher who wrote of coffee's medicinal properties. Quote, "It is a drink that is good for those with hot nature, but it decreases the libido."
Huh.
He was actually kind of, from what I understand, famous for these good thing, bad thing reviews about stuff.
No, that's good. You're covering all the bases. I like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Roasting coffee beans to make the drink we're more familiar with today didn't become a thing until at least 1000 to 1200 CE on the Arabian Peninsula, again, modern-day Yemen, where it was highly regarded for the energy it provided and was particularly popular among the Muslim community. According to Mental Floss, coffee, or perhaps coffee leaf tea, was sometimes passed around at funerals or other events to stay awake and alert during long prayer sessions. Folks were growing coffee in modern-day Egypt, Syria, Turkey, and Persia by the 16th century.
And public coffee houses sprung up in cities in these areas, becoming spaces for all sorts of social interactions, music and games, conversation, news. This earned them the nickname Schools of the Wise. And the first documented coffee house opened in what's now Istanbul in 1554, though they probably existed around various places before then. As the Ottoman Empire conquered and spread, and with them Muslim prohibitions against alcohol, so did a taste for kaveh, literally the wine of Arabia, a.k.a. coffee.
The Yemeni port city of Mocha was a major trading hub for coffee from the 15th to 17th centuries. Mocha was known for mocha beans, highly sought after for their strong sort of chocolatey flavor, although separate from the chocolatey drinks we conflate it with these days.
Yeah, that was a European thing.
Exactly.
Later.
It does have like a chocolatey kind of flavor profile, but it's not what we think of it when we hear it perhaps in our Western parlance.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that the Arabian Peninsula controlled the coffee bean market through the end of the 1500s by parching and boiling the beans to make them infertile. And as a result, not one coffee plant grew outside of Africa or Arabia. That changed shortly after the turn of the century. And there are a few legends about how that went.
Mm-hmm.
Some say that an Indian saint by the name of Baba Budan, who made the pilgrimage to Mecca, fell in love with coffee and smuggled 7 fertile coffee beans out, either strapped to his chest or hidden in his beard.
I like that version.
I do, too. I hope that's the true one. Peter van de Broek was able to sneak some coffee beans out of Mocha into Amsterdam in 1616.
The first European-owned coffee estate got its start in Indonesia in the late 1600s. The Dutch opened up shop in Sri Lanka and Java. The mayor of Amsterdam gifted King Louis XIV with a coffee plant in 1714, and the king proceeded to plant it in Paris's Royal Botanical Gardens. And about a decade later, a French naval officer, oh, would you help me with the name, Annie?
Gabriel de Cleur.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that guy undertook this arduous journey, allegedly complete with a saboteur, to Martinique with a seedling from this coffee plant. The seedling flourished and spawned over 18 million coffee plants over the next 50 years on Martinique. The Spanish established coffee in Central America soon after, and the Portuguese after that with an estate in Brazil. Legend has it that the Portuguese tasked one Francisco de Melo Paleta to go to French Guiana in order to obtain a seedling and get in on this whole coffee business. The French declined to share, but the French governor's wife was so smitten with Francisco that she bestowed him as a going-away present this bouquet of flowers, within which there were hidden coffee sprouts.
Oh, no.
Love it. From those, Brazil went on to become the biggest heavy hitter in the coffee world. As trade became increasingly global, so did coffee. And unfortunately, so did the populations of enslaved peoples who were the ones actually growing it.
Meanwhile, the first European coffee houses opened in Italy in 1645, and England in 1650, and then in France in 1672, soon followed by most of the rest of Europe. Europeans loved these coffee houses.
Mm-hmm.
According to legend, French poet Voltaire, who's, you know, up and around 1694, drank a daily 40 to 50 cups
Ooh,
of coffee.
That's dangerous.
Voltaire was living on the edge.
His cups were very small. I don't know.
It could be.
Anyway.
We don't know. These coffee houses, too, became hubs of intelligent discourse. England even had what they called penny universities. A penny got you a cup of coffee and all the intellectual discourse you could ask for. 300 of these were up and running in London by the mid-17th century. Coffee began to edge out the previous go-to breakfast drinks, beer and wine. Also of note, women generally weren't allowed in these coffee houses because they might be exposed to the gasp, foul language or obscene conversation.
Pearl clutch.
Yes. You can see our tea episode, our tea time episode, for more on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Not all Europeans welcomed coffee with open arms, though. One review from the Time labeled it the bitter invention of Satan.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I might be into it, though.
Yeah, I know, right?
What I'm does like that this... say about me? Oh, I'm... color me in.
At any rate, in 1635, the Venetian clergy condemned coffee, and the ensuing uproar called for Pope Clement VIII to weigh in. And after trying some of this, you know, coffee beverage in question, he deemed that it would not, in fact, send you to hell, and that it was indeed delicious. Purportedly, he said, "This devil's drink is so delicious, we should cheat the devil by baptizing it."
Jury is still out on whether this was a literal or metaphorical baptism, or if any baptism at all took place. But throughout history, there have been a few attempts to ban the drink. One of the first actually took place in Mecca in 1511 due to the governor's fear at that time that coffee would unite his dissenters who were hanging out at coffee houses and talking about politics. Uh-huh. Yeah, and this ban lasted mere weeks before being overturned. That's actually a common theme throughout these mm-hmm. bans we're going to discuss.
Yeah.
In 1633, after Sultan Murad IV took the Ottoman throne, he banned public coffee consumption, particularly in the coffee houses in Istanbul. Allegedly, he would wander the streets in disguise to find rule breakers to punish.
Huh.
Stories about how he punished them are so brutal,
huh.
Like the stuff of legend, hard to say what is fact and what isn't. But according to some records, the first offense called for a beating, while the second called for a sewing of the offender into a bag and then tossing them into the Bosporus Strait.
Oh.
That's a pretty big step.
That is. That's a pretty intense... It's just coffee, man. Gosh.
It's just coffee, man.
Back in Europe, when coffee started gaining popularity there in the 1600s, some winemakers struck back. They were like, oh, no, you're not taking away our breakfast wine.
No.
One winemaker in Marseille enlisted this university student to write a thesis on why coffee was bad for your health. And this poor student wrote, burnt particles, which coffee contains in large quantities, have so violent energy that when they enter the blood, they attract the lymph and dry the kidneys, leading to general exhaustion, paralysis, and impotence.
Not impotence!
Anything but that!
While it wasn't banned per se related, London women in 1674 believed drinking coffee rendered their husbands impotent, and some racist articles came out against the beverage around the same time. The article that these women wrote in London is often compared to, like, the most sexual, make you blush Shakespeare passages.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I read it and was like, I don't really get it. I mean, I overall get it, but I feel like a lot of your little slights, your little puns are going right over my head.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It happens. It's okay.
Yeah. Paranoid Swedish King Gustav III banned coffee and coffee paraphernalia in 1756. They're coming for your coffee cups!
Oh, no!
Your coffee dishes! He went a step further. He was trying to prove that coffee was bad for your health. He was trying to use science to his benefit to get rid of coffee. So he found this pair of twin convicts who were sentenced to death, and he instead gave them the option to live out a life sentence so that they could be a part of a coffee experiment.
Okay.
Okay. Basically, one twin drank 3 pots of tea a day, and the other drank 3 pots of coffee a day.
Okay.
With the hopes, this whole thing proving coffee will kill you.
Sure.
So doctors were taking notes of how many cups of coffee it would take to kill this
oh,
guy,
my gosh.
Which turned out to be quite anticlimactic, as the twins reportedly outlived the doctors. And not only that, the tea drinker died before the coffee drinker did. So the king's experiment failed. Also of note of this whole thing, it was very similar in that he was afraid of, like, political discourse in coffee houses.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what he was paranoid about.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I love all of this.
Yeah.
And then
In 1777, Prussia's Frederick the Great declared that beer was officially better than coffee and that you should be drinking it instead of coffee as part of your balanced breakfast. Again, booze breakfast. Upheaval.
Right.
This was partially an attempt to boost Prussia's beer-making industry. From the 1922 book All About Coffee by one William Harrison Uecker, Frederick the Great said, "It is disgusting to notice the increase in the quantity of coffee used by my subjects and the amount of money that goes out of the country in consequence. Everybody is using coffee. If possible, this must be prevented. My people must drink beer. His Majesty was brought up on beer, and so were his ancestors and his officers. Many battles have been fought and won by soldiers nourished on beer, and the king does not believe that coffee-drinking soldiers can be depended upon to endure hardship or to beat his enemies in the case of the occurrence of another war."
Wow. Also, some of that money went straight to this guy, by the way.
Oh. Well. Yeah, the restrictions were lifted after Frederick the Great's death in 1786.
Yeah, pretty shortly after. Coffee made its way to the New World by the beginning of the 18th century, but it really wasn't a thing here until 1773 and the Boston Tea Party. Boston boasted the first coffee house in what would become the U.S. circa 1676. Out with the tea! In with the coffee. Drinking coffee over tea was viewed as patriotic. There's even a famous letter written by John Adams, I believe to his wife, where he was like, "I must wean myself off tea. It is a matter of patriotism, but it will be difficult." I love it. Spite.
And taxes. Spite and taxes.
Spite and taxes, yep. Huh. Thomas Jefferson called coffee, quote, "the favorite drink of the civilized world." Mm. That's kind of surprising, actually, because he was such a big fan of wine. But all right. big ideas were born in coffee houses again, at least in part, such as the French and American revolutions.
And conflicts like the Civil War helped increase coffee's consumption as it gave soldiers a little bit of pep. Although, as we discussed in our okra episode.
I know.
Of all episodes. Yeah, the South was largely cut off from the coffee supply, so Confederate soldiers had to resort to something else. And yes, it is okra related.
It is. Check out that episode if you're befuddled at how that could possibly be. Teddy Roosevelt was rumored to be up there with Voltaire in his coffee consumption, downing a gallon a day. One story even goes that after he enjoyed some Maxwell House coffee at Andrew Jackson's historical home, he came up with the slogan, "Good to the last drop."
Huh.
Yes. And I think Maxwell House is the coffee of the American Army.
Oh.
Yeah. Huh. Or at least it was.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess speaking of, John Dring received a patent for compound coffee in Britain in 1771, what we would now call instant coffee. However, it would be a century later before it started to take off because it was honestly kind of terrible.
Yeah.
The first commercial instant coffee was thought for a long time to be the product of this Japanese chemist by the name of Satori Kato in 1901. But recently, a patent for soluble coffee powder dating back to 1890 resurfaced from a New Zealander by the name of David Strang.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spanish explorer Don Francisco de Palamarin brought coffee to Hawaii in 1817, but his plantings failed. However, he inspired the royal governor of Oahu, Boki, to bring coffee plants from Brazil, and he successfully planted them in the Manoa Valley in 1825. From there, coffee planting spread throughout the islands. In 1828, an American missionary and reverend by the name of Samuel Ruggles took some cuttings to Kona. The first commercial operation was up and running in the mid-1830s. While coffee for sure took a backseat to sugar production on the islands, it earned a reputation of being a superior coffee product. In 1866, Mark Twain told the Sacramento Daily Union, "Kona coffee has a richer flavor than any other, be it grown where it may and call it by what name you please." Okay. A Kona coffee farmer showcased some of his product at the 1873 Vienna World's Fair, where it was recognized for its excellence.
Meanwhile, the first people to sell bags of roasted beans by the pound may have been the Arbuckle brothers out of Pittsburgh in 1864. That year, they purchased some self-emptying coffee bean roasters, which was this new hot invention on the market. They called their coffee Ariosa, and cowboys in the American West were apparently big fans, bought a whole bunch of it. By 1906, the Arbuckle brothers were roasting 25 million pounds of coffee a month, and John Arbuckle was known as the Coffee King.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Soon after that, James Folger took note and began selling a similar product, specifically to the California gold miners. And then the Hills brothers and Maxwell House followed soon after.
Going back to Hawaii, a new strain of Guatemalan Arabica was introduced there in 1892. This new varietal went on to become the most commonly grown coffee plant. Another change took place at the beginning of the 20th century when many of the large coffee plantations parceled out their land to tenant farmers, many of whom were Japanese immigrants, about 80% by 1910.
Whew.
Yeah.
It was also around this time that European inventors were working on a way to speed up the coffee brewing process and, you know, just bless their hearts for trying, because yeah. I respect that.
Mm-hmm.
In Turin, Italy, in 1884, one Angelo Moriando filed a patent for a new steam machinery for the economic and instantaneous confection of coffee beverage.
Ooh.
This machine often gets credit for being the first of what would become our modern-day methods of brewing espresso. Other inventors improved upon it over the next century. Again, whole other episode.
Yes.
And as for the coffee maker, that was most likely invented by Melita Bentz in 1908. She used blotting paper as her filter, resulting in a drip coffee that a lot of us are familiar with today.
Yes. When it was established in 1911, the National Coffee Association, which was a group of growers, roasters, importers, distributors, traders, and retailers, became one of America's first trade associations.
Huh.
Yeah, the demand for coffee for soldiers during World War I led to innovations around instant coffee. Just add water in the field. It's estimated American soldiers polished off thousands of pounds of coffee per day. This demand was a huge boost for Kona coffee as well. Estimates suggest that around 2.7 million pounds of Kona coffee was produced in 1916.
Nescafe launched in 1938, and to this day, it is the most consumed instant coffee in the world, with 74% of the market. Freeze-dried coffee came along in 1964, and around the same time, interest in specialty coffee started to take root here in the United States in the 1960s or so, leading to the birth of a chain that you might have heard of.
Maybe.
In 1971. Yep, we're talking about Starbucks.
Starbucks is critical in convincing coffee consumers that it's worth spending more money on this thing from a place that's different and worthwhile. And the idea of that is predates Starbucks, right? The idea of specialty coffee predates them. And it's just an idea that this coffee tastes different from this coffee and there's special attributes to it, and we should pay attention to that. And that was sort of the birth of specialty coffee. It really spread well because of companies like Starbucks and Peet's and Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, who just had great outreach. And that's coincident with the small mom and pop shops coming out of, you know, beatnik hippie age. Mm-hmm.
Starbucks also, whole other episode.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
I'm telling you, we could, so many of these opened doors that I wanted to go down.
Yeah. We just, like, saw them swing open and we were like, sorry, bye, as we continued down the hallway.
One day.
Yeah.
We have to go to classroom 101B right now. Yeah. The 70s is also when Mr. Coffee, the first automatic home brewing drip machine, entered the market. And yeah, this interest in specialty coffee and different ways of consuming it has led to all kinds of coffee innovations, including this one right here.
Oh, yeah.
But first, let's set the scene a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. The year 1995.
Okay.
A man by the name of John Sylvan rushed to the hospital after experiencing heart attack-like symptoms.
Oh, no.
Yes. But his diagnosis wasn't a heart attack or a brain injury. So the doctors went through a list of lifestyle questions, found most of his answers pretty bland.
Uh-huh.
Nothing suggestive. But then, when the doctors asked Sylvan how much coffee he had had that morning, he answered, 30 or 40 cups.
30 or 40? Okay.
Yep.
Cups. That
cups.
Morning.
Yes. So caffeine poisoning was the culprit because For 3 years prior, Sylvan and his business partner had been working on a new type of coffee machine. So caffeine poisoning was a risk that came with the territory.
Gosh, you don't have to drink all of it. Like, spit cups are a thing. Friend.
You know, I, in some ways, I appreciate the determination.
Sure.
But they called this a new type of coffee machine Keurig.
Oh. Mm-hmm,
which they got out of a Dutch dictionary, I believe.
Huh.
And it used pods of pre-ground coffee to brew a single cup. The original pods they used came from the same company that made Jell-O shot cups. I love it. Today, after numerous failed prototypes and rejection from venture capitalists, and also Sylvan leaving with only about $50,000, Keurig is worth billions of dollars. 13% of American workplaces use a Keurig. And one out of every four home brewing coffee devices in 2010 in the U.S. was Keurig.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. Lately, they have come under fire for the amount of waste that their pods generate. In response, Keurig has pledged that their pods will be 100% recyclable by 2020. Starbucks' version of the Keurig, the very small, debuted in 2012, boasting, I believe, 100% recyclable packaging, mostly recyclable packaging.
Hmm.
So that's also another episode we could return to.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I happen to have seen the inside of a Keurig office recently.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
And their walls of coffee selection are sights to behold.
Yes.
It is intense.
I believe it. There are so many flavors.
Yeah. And they had them.
Was this in Boston?
Maybe.
Maybe not. I like the the vagueness. I won't follow up with any clarifications. You can live your mystery life, Lauren.
Any rate.
At any rate.
Yeah, that about brings us to the present. We do have some more for you about this specialty coffee we keep talking about and about the flavors of coffee. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. So, one thing that Sean was really passionate about sharing was the disconnect between coffee experts and consumers, particularly when it comes to specialty coffee, which are coffees that are batch-produced instead of mass-produced, with particular care for the beans and also for the people along the supply chain. And all of that is great, amazing, but it does raise the question, how do we quantify and scientifically measure good versus bad when it comes to taste?
There's no right answer.
Right.
That's a truncated version. So who gets to make all the rules and say things, right? That's pretty tricky. But there is a specialty coffee association. It is now a global thing. And they, in some sense, do have a right to sort of lay down some law. Or to lay down some suggestions, if you will. That's kind of taken as law.
Uh-huh.
When you're big enough and seem nice enough, that's what happens. And I'm a member of the community and I participate greatly and I'm a big fan. But one of the things that I really struggled with approaching this is from a scientific perspective is this idea of what good and bad was and how do we talk about what we're tasting and who eventually gets to decide what is good or bad is, right? It sort of stemmed from this notion that you go into a liquor store to buy a bottle of wine and they got all these numbers on them and the presumption is that the higher the number, the better it is. But then you get it and you might not be that excited about it or you might like the lower number better or it doesn't make any sense to you. And there's a fallacy going on that nobody talks about. And if you dig deep enough, what's happening is the people who make these scales and these scoring systems and these numberings, right? The closer you get to 100, the better it is. It's really subjective. And there's nothing wrong with a subjective analysis of something or a subjective conversation about something. It's important to say I like this or not. But if you're trying to say, I like this a lot, I'm going to give it a higher number, and therefore everybody else should think it's better and higher than worthwhile. Well, what are you really saying? You're not saying anything about the product. You're saying something about the preference of the user.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with experts is that they don't like simple things anymore, right? They started with Folgers or Budweiser or box wine, right? What is cheap and affordable and got them the kick they needed. They slowly found that was okay and they explored a little bit. Like, oh, this coffee thing is yummy. I like the flavor of coffee. But after a while, the flavor of coffee gets boring. So you want more things. So you keep increasing its complexity level to a point where it doesn't really taste like coffee anymore. And then the experts say, ah, this is the good stuff. And then someone comes and drinks it and says, this doesn't taste like coffee. I don't understand. And there is a formal definition of specialty coffee, and there's a 100-point scale, and people use it. But I think it's a terrible system for communication because of this inherent problem of the subjectivity. But it's easy to say, oh, this is an 85, and that can convey some information. It's really hard to say, well, this tastes like walnuts and flowers in coffee and has a lot of acidity, and it kind of tastes like gym socks. That just takes longer, and it's confusing for people to think about those things. Because the reality is, we don't learn to talk about our experiences.
This can be a problem when your job involves taste testing and describing coffee, one thing that I'm notoriously bad at. That's why experts use a method called coffee cupping in order to professionally evaluate coffee. Although it can be done informally, if for anyone who's interested, it's very similar to wine tasting and similarly valuable when it comes to rating something that is often so subjective.
So the more we cannot be human, the better off we are. Because humans are wonderful. We think and we feel and we interact and we've been laughing all morning. But we're really terrible at being instruments because of those things. Because we think and we feel. So if we can create situations that are not typical of being a human, it helps us be less human. So we're all drinking coffee right now. And we're drinking out of cups and it's fun and we're laughing. We're engaging conversation. And I had coffee this morning with my daughter while she was eating her oatmeal and having breakfast. And every time we do something as humans, we capture part of it in our minds and we internalize it, it becomes part of us. And it just is always there. So if I'm trying to evaluate this cup of coffee, I'm going to bring a little bit of all my past experiences of holding a mug and drinking it with me. So wouldn't it be better if I had a way of drinking coffee that I only did when I was trying to be an instrument? So sure enough, I never drink coffee for fun with a spoon. I suspect most people don't. So cupping has this magical ability to let us have this system of, oh, I'm only tasting and experiencing this as a taster. There's also lots of other things we should do, but right, there's scientific precision versus industry practicality. That's just a statement to make, not a conversation to have. So that's the most important thing cupping does. And I want to tie in this idea about good versus bad and experts versus normal drinker. Experts are people who want an intellectual and emotional challenge from the product that they're consuming because they're bored with the paradigm of that thing. So they don't want coffee to taste like coffee. They want coffee to taste like something else because they're bored with coffee taste. But as we've talked about, what happens is that experts are the ones who have their own soapboxes and they say, this is what good is. This is what we like. This is the amazing stuff. Without an appreciation of what people actually want to drink. Right? More people buy Folgers than buy specialty coffee. That says something about what people want. So who is an expert to say what good or bad is? Right? That shouldn't be the role of the expert. The expert's role should be, this is what this is. Based on what you know about you, what I know about you, this is probably what you'll like. And you can include all those factors of accessibility and price and effort to produce it in your home or your restaurant or whatever. But the problem with our culture is that, oh, if there's an expert and the expert knows what's going on and the expert we trust, then I should be somehow adhering to that. And that's ridiculous because you are allowed to like what you like and we're all going to like different things and you shouldn't let somebody else tell you what you should like. Now, with time and patience, you might try a product and then move into a different aspect of it, get a more complex version to please you, but you may not. Just because an expert says drink your coffee black doesn't mean you should ever try it black and drink it black. Sure, our hearts are coffee experts. We all want everybody to appreciate the way we do. But that's selfish and ridiculous. And even though I fall in that trap sometimes, and I compliment everybody here in this room about drinking their coffee black, you know, there's a piece of us that admires that. But experts are just people who like what they like. Their understanding of something is greater, maybe deeper than a non-expert's, but that doesn't make them their opinion about something's taste any better or worse than yours. So there's no right answer and there's no thing you have to like. But people should be, I mean, in a sense, right? Be yourself. It's sort of the message there. I think that's really important. I think the coffee industry would do much better for itself if it gave a message of inclusivity versus exclusivity. There's a really amazing coffee person based in London named James Hoffman, and it's a shame you can't interview him. He says so many wonderful things about coffee all the time. Just left him to pieces. And he was giving a talk once about behaviors of coffee shops. And, you know, secretly, all of us coffee people say, drink your coffee black. We really want that. But we don't promote that. What we do is we give away milk and sugar in our cafes. Mm-hmm. Don't do this thing, but here, have this free thing that you're not supposed to do. That's pretty insightful. And in fact, you actually want to go more insightful, my own insight, to try and play at James's level. With black drip coffee, right, it's frowned upon to add milk. But with espresso-based drinks, we have competitions that celebrate adding milk to coffee. Espresso is just coffee. Why is it okay to add milk there but not in my drip? It's a weird dynamic. We're stuck in our rut and we don't see a bigger picture in coffee.
Of course, part of that bigger picture isn't just including average consumers in the conversation. It's also including the growers. We promised we would come back to that dark side of coffee that we mentioned earlier.
It's a good time. It's always been a good time to have the conversation. It's always been an important time to have the conversation. Now it's really a good time in coffee industry. Coffee evolved in Ethiopia, where it was consumed in various ways for a long time. It left Ethiopia, went to Yemen, and it's through Yemen that the world discovered coffee. And Yemen had control of it for a while. Eventually, the Western powers got a hold of it and didn't want to have to pay what they were paying from Africa and the Middle East to have their coffee. And there were Western powers at the time who had lots of guns and lots of colonies. So coffee became a product that they took to their colonies to have and to make lots of money off of. All of South America, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, anywhere coffee's grown that's not Africa, basically, came from a Western power who wanted to have coffee cheaply, like spices or anything else.
Sure.
And this is all started at a time when slavery was perfectly okay, and whether they're slaves or slave labor, didn't matter. Mm-hmm. So coffee became the backbone of many economies because of powerful Western powers. Slowly, of course, those relationships shifted and all those places are now independent. That doesn't mean that the base of the system changed or improved. And part of the issue is that lots and lots of places grow coffee. So there's some, depending on how you define it, right? There's some 80-odd countries, if you go look at world figures, that produce coffee. And probably between 50 and 60 of them that produce it to sell as a commodity. Mm-hmm. So 50 or 60 countries is, you know, about a quarter of the world's countries. You know, there's a range of coffees that are grown, but on the global scale, that's a lot of coffee being produced. There's a lot of drinkers, mind you, but that's a lot of coffee being produced. And when you have that much being produced, it's basically a commodity. And it's not like the individual farmer who might not be literate and lives in the middle of nowhere with no running water and has no education is going to stand up for himself and say, you know what, my coffee's better. It demands a higher price, right? They have their hands tied in many ways about how they can deal with that. And so you've got this global competition. Your neighbor's coffee, by neighbor, I mean one country next to another, will have somewhat different economic systems, but they're all going to suffer from this global commodity issue. And there is a global commodity price for coffee, and it fluctuates. And it's not just how much coffee is available to sell and who gets to own it. There's the futures market and there's investors and there's big companies planning ahead and there's guessing what the yield's going to be this year, next year. And there's all the mess of commodities that coffee suffers through. And there's no incentive by anyone who has the power to make a difference to make a difference, because the difference to make is to give more money to the farmers, but that's not how capitalism works. So that doesn't change in any way. And what tends to happen is that this global C price for coffee goes up and down over time. And currently, as we are speaking, it's incredibly low. We're in crisis mode. Crisis mode being it costs a farmer more to produce their coffee than they can sell it for.
Wow.
And most companies, because we have this third party C market commodity, no one's really at fault for thing. Like big people just say, oh, that's just the way the system works, without saying a system's really not helping the people who need help. Yeah. Like I'm buying this thing from people who are in crisis with their lives. And I don't really care because, you know, they're far away. And this is very like, you know, neat package version I'm giving you.
One of his proposed solutions?
Pay more for coffee. That's a good start. Buy coffee from sources that really seem to be buying more directly from a farmer, that are really focusing on quality and stories. So if you're being drawn in by marketing, it's probably a good coffee to buy. I sort of hate to say that because I don't want to deal with the marketing. But if some roaster or company is telling you about this farmer they've met, or the picture that they're showing you this farmer, or somehow this experience, well, there's a lot of marketing hoo-ha around that. There probably is some better money going, because, you know, everybody has to make more money for that to work.
We're always a proponent of knowing where the things we consume come from and the people behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And that about brings us to the end of this episode. Oh, man. So many other topics to return to.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
Oh, gosh, indeed. We were just discussing before we came in how the cravings of this episode were not helpful in our overall goal to consume less coffee.
Because every time I finish a cup, like I would just be like, oh, more coffee research. And they would be like, coffee.
Exactly. There's something so ritualistic about it, too. Comforting. I'm starting off the day, or I'm like,
it's warm. It's refreshing. It gives you that pep. It gives you that dopamine that's like, oh, everything's going to be just okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do find that, and I know we've done an episode on this before, not us specifically, but us as in our massive company. Mm-hmm. After I have coffee, I frequently get really tired.
Oh.
Like 30 minutes later.
Huh.
And if I can write it out, I'm fine. But I know several people in the office have said they experience the same thing, where they get tired after having coffee. So another thing to come back to.
Yeah. Oh, so much science.
Yes. And if there's any particular aspect of coffee science or coffee machinery or coffee types
or cultural
French press,
practices,
Turkish, oh my gosh,
all of this coffee like ceremonies, stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes. Please write in if you want us to do any episodes around that, or if you have any information you'd like to share around that.
Absolutely.
And you can do that via our email. It is hello@saverpod.com.
Or you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard, and our executive producer, Christopher Hasiotis, and Sean.
Yeah.
Dr. Coffee. If you would like to hear more from Sean, check out those books. His books are The Hawaii Coffee Book, A Gourmet's Guide from Kona to Kauai, then also Coffee, A Comprehensive Guide to the Bean, the Beverage, and the Industry, and then also The Little Coffee Know-It-All, A Miscellany for Growing, Roasting, and Brewing, Uncompromising and Unapologetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Check those out.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks also to Michelle McGowan Rice of the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, Joy Goto and Maria Hartfield of the Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau, and particularly, in this case, Don Sakamoto Paiva of Put It On My Plate, for putting us in touch with Sean and all of our other guests. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way. They called their coffee Ariosa?
It's Ariosa, not Ariosa.